Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second edition of a yet-to-be-named podcast featuring Patrick McEwen and Kyle Davitt as your hosts. The proposed name is potentially off-topic.
Well, I mean, not potentially off-topic. It's just off-topic. Maybe, like, off-topic with Patrick and Kyle. Kyle and Patrick, however that flows, however you like it. I think people like that kind of the play on there. I mean, the reason it's off topic, folks, is not because of anything we talk on the podcast. It's because before the podcast, we have basically our own podcast of stuff we can't say and topics that we can't talk about. And that's what we'll be naming it for.
Yeah, I think it's potentially more descriptive of us as people in conversation than how we're going to be on the podcast, I think. We'll see. The last podcast, I thought we stayed on topic very well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But it was the first one, so it could be beginner's luck. Hopefully not.
That's true. We also spent a decent amount of time prepping in terms of topics we're going to come up with. But anyways, the first thing that we want to talk about is last weekend, July 4th, was a launch date, or the July 1st that week was a launch date for a lot of new heads. And being that you are the gear editor for Inside Lacrosse, we are going to talk a little bit about some of those heads. You have one you want to tackle first?
Yeah, I'm actually holding in my hands right now the Maverick Tactic. Came to my door today, courtesy of one of the product managers, Billy Bitter. Maybe you heard of him, former attackman at UNC. This head is kind of like, Maverick keeps doing this like in-between thing with their heads where, you know, they have the optic and then they had the tank and they had the metric at first, and then the metric kind of got replaced by the centric. And now the Tactic is kind of that next level, all positions, mid-level pocket head. It actually suits my personal style very well because I am a mid-pocket guy, mid-pocket for life. The cutouts on this head are really interesting in terms of the throat. You can see where they shaved out a lot of, you know, weight. The holes at the bottom are bigger for leathers. So traditional guys will like this a lot more, I think, than past Maverick models. And also the biggest thing on this head is not even the offset or anything else. The biggest thing on this head is that they made the stringing holes on the sidewall much bigger. I would say they're at least double, and they made them rather, I guess it's a rhomboid or a rhombus, a rhomboidal shape there, as well as the top. The holes on the top are that same kind of not quite square, four-sided shape. Lots of manipulation available there. There's a big gap in the middle of the head, between the middle two stringing holes, which I think is really cool. It's like, hey, come string a triangle top string here. I thought that was really cool. I haven't strung it yet. I'm actually really looking forward to stringing it. As far as I know, this is only going to be available in U-Spec, which I think is a universal spec, not high school, which is going to be, I think, a theme this year. I think this is the first year that all the new heads that companies are coming out with are not going to have high school spec options. I could be wrong. That's pure speculation. I haven't seen everyone's catalog, but I think this is the year.
Well, there's only one more year of high school heads. I wonder if this is going to be the start of going back to the, I guess, X6 was what a lot of companies, or what somebody, I think Warrior called it, where yes. You have the college only one, where it's pinched, it's only 6 across the top instead of 6.5. Because now with the high school rules changing to the college rules for 2018, there's the potential that you might see that coming back in style.
Yeah, I think, too, one of the other things you're going to see, we're going to talk about some other heads in a second, but one of the things you see with a lot of these heads is that they're not crazy complicated, right? Like, there was a phase there where companies were really overdoing it. I mean, they're still kind of, in my opinion, still kind of overdoing it with all these like weird textures that like anybody who dyes a head. I have a couple of guys that do dyes for me, Gopher Lax, Dark Star dyes for Inside Lacrosse. And they hate all these heads with texture on them because you can't get the vinyl down. You can't get a nice set. You can't make clean lines. The Tactic has a little bit of that up by the scoop, but most of it is a gloss or matte finish around the head. I think that's kind of the new, you know, texture mapping was the new phase. And now we're kind of going back to like something really basic, really simple, and like, you know, using maybe a little bit of science to make your head.
the next head or pair of heads, I'm not really sure if we should speak about them in these singular or the plural, are the Brine Dictator and Dictator ST, which are the new face-off heads from Brine, developed with feedback from Brendan Fowler, who's an awesome guy. Shout out to him. And they're an identically constructed head. The difference is that the Dictator, the regular, is a little bit more flexible, and the Dictator ST uses a different blend of polymers, a different, you know, nylon resin for the injection molding that makes it stiffer. So you're going to get, it's the same design, but one is a little bit stiffer, one's a little bit more flexible, which I think is something that I wish it's something I thought that companies should do for a while, given the difference in materials and how that impacts the head and people's stiffness, flexibility preferences. You save on design costs by designing the same head, but still give people one more option in what they're choosing a head to suit their preferences by just using a different blend of polymers to create a different stiffness with the plastic.
Yeah. I mean, we couldn't come up with a better name than Dictator. Was like the Brine Fascist was taken. Like, really? Like, I get it. Like, I get you're dictating the play, but like, I don't know. I think it's funny, like, all these heads have like weird names now. Like, the Tactic isn't even spelled correctly. I mean, none of the Maverick heads are, because they have a K at the end of their name, but whatever.
Yeah, they at least have a theme, which is kind of nice. You can instantly know by the name of a head and how they spell it that it's a Maverick head. I don't mind that. I think they're going to run out of words to use at some point pretty soon. But
yeah, there's only so many of those words you can. I'm waiting for the Maniac. That's my next Maverick head. I want you guys to make the Maniac.
With an AK, but they're all AK. They're all IK
for now. But I just think it'd be cool to have a head named that, as opposed to, like, you know, the Brine Mussolini or whatever this is.
Yeah, I think it's probably not the best name, but I don't necessarily have a problem with it.
No, I know. I was just making a joke. So seeing this head, it has this really strange kind of fill in the middle of the sidewall that looks like a stringing hole and isn't. And I'm almost positive that suggests kind of dictate where the flex point is going to be. I'm interested to see. Also, the shape of this head is very old school keyhole shape, very reminiscent, just the face, not the offset or anything, just the face, very reminiscent of the STX Bionic, if you remember that head at all. It used to be a D head, but they had John Grant Jr. using that head in the NLL when STX had Jr. Sponsored a way long time ago. But yeah, I think it's an interesting kind of concept to just make heads for one position. The funny thing is, like, the best face-off head of all time is generally regarded as the Blade, and the Blade wasn't made for facing off. The Blade was made for attackment because it had that crazy keyhole shape, and I think the Dictator kind of harkens back to that, you know, Brine and Maverick basically being the same kind of thing with different development teams, so.
Not Brine and Maverick, but Warrior and Brine?
Yeah, sorry. Warrior and Brine.
Potentially, though, I think some of that is just that I wonder, there's a lot of the number of sort of failed concepts with heads, how much research and development some of the old, like, that companies used to actually put into heads before launching them made me wonder that. I think that was an accident. They didn't really brand things as face-off heads, you know, 10, 15 years ago when the blade came out. It was just sort of that they had offensive heads and there's a couple heads aimed at defense, but they sort of just let guys use whatever they, and a lot of midfielders were just using whatever head they liked for offense to face off with, because you didn't have the specialization that you have nowadays in terms of face off guys.
Right. Totally true.
So I think it makes sense. I mean, I think it makes sense that the specialization in heads is keeping pace with the specialization, or it means not keeping pace, it's lagging behind, but it's catching up to the specialization we've seen on the field from face-off guys.
Right. And we can have a whole, we could talk about face-off heads forever, or just heads forever. But, you know, the next head I think is actually pretty cool. I actually got to see this head in person, string it up for one of the people in charge at this company. And that's the Epic Prequel, which we unveiled on the site last week, I believe. And I actually got to see when I went to Minnesota to Epic's headquarters, got to string some up with some Epic Otter Mesh and try it out. It's interesting. You talk about companies using R&D and design. This is they purport this head to be basically a mathematically perfect head. And I think you're the person to talk to about that, because I would love to hear your thoughts on someone making that claim.
Yeah, so I have looked at it. Unlike you, I haven't gotten a chance. By the way, Epic, if you want to fix this for me, I haven't gotten a chance to actually play around with their new prequel head to kind of give it my in-person review. But I have looked at the math, the kind of their purported, the diagrams they've drawn up. And some of the tricky part is I don't know how to compare it to other heads. I don't have those measurements, offhand, and they'd be difficult to do without the CAD drawings,
right?
To measure, what is the distance from like the breakpoint in the bottom rail to the scoop, and how far is the scoop below the center line of the axis of the handle. So I think it's difficult for me. It's difficult to really compare it to other heads to say if it is true, the mathematically optimization. But the one thing that they do talk about is the distance in terms of the quick release, the distance from where the ball sits to the release point. And that's something that a lot of people, it's sort of, I feel like, a common theory. I mean, you see a lot of times when people talk about defensive heads where you want a high pocket so that you get a quick release of the ground, the ball ends up in the stick, in the pocket quickly. And that's something that I always have been skeptical of, because the distance the ball travels relative to the head is, you were talking inches, whatever that distance is, it's a matter of 4, 5, 6, maybe 3 inches if it's really short, somewhere in that range. But a quick release is about a throwing motion, and the distance the head travels during your release is going to be feet. Maybe on a super quick one, you're talking a foot and a half, like 18 inches from the back cock of your throw to where the release point forward. If you're talking a big arcing shot, it might be 4 or 5 feet of the ball, 6, 7 feet the ball is traveling in the head of your stick through that swing. And so that's, I guess, the discrepancy. I don't know. I'm skeptical that the distance the ball travels relative to the head makes an impact on how far on, or how that correlates to the release motion.
Right.
If that makes sense.
No, it does, because, it's always, people always think it's just the pocket. It's just the pocket. It's just where the offset point is on the head. There's so many other factors in determining when, release point itself is like a relative variable term that everyone uses, not wrong, but perhaps a little too liberally when they're talking about heads and pocket shape and all that stuff and channel. And there's all sorts of different theories on that. I think your point is well received, that you can have, the optimal mathematical head in the non-optimal mathematic arm strength and shape length and still not get results. I think there is a lot to be said for the wizard, not the wand, as a lot of people are fond to say, that are nerds. But I think that definitely works in terms of describing how a head can, like, I actually really think that a poorly strung head can make you worse, but a averagely strung head is not going to make you better.
No, that's 100% true. I think it's the right way to approach it. It's just, and I would also add that I just think the tricky part is knowing how, and some of it's going to depend on the individual mechanics, how is a head and the stringing that the head ends up with. Because I think the pocket, in a lot of ways, is more important in terms of, for a quick release than the actual head itself. But how does that impact your throwing motion? And does it lend itself to a quicker throwing motion and getting to that release point more quickly with your throwing motion?
Right.
And that to me is what's important.
That's true.
Like high pockets that have a lot of whip, the whole point of doing that is actually to get a really slow release.
Right.
Because you want the ball to stay stuck in your stick so you can get it up to a really high velocity.
Right.
That's why women's sticks, you can't shoot very fast because the ball comes out too quickly. The release is too quick to get much velocity.
Right.
Whereas guys like Ryan Brown and Sergio Perkovic need to play with a lot more whip because you just can't get the ball up to 100 plus miles an hour unless you have a slow release.
Right. It's a misnomer
on the stick.
Yeah, it's a misnomer to have quick release and high whip, you know, in the same sentence. That doesn't.
Right.
It's not
exactly.
True. It's not possible. Exactly.
One last head I think that's worth mentioning, the Adidas Goalie head.
Oh, yeah.
That they came out with.
Yeah, it looks really interesting. Very. I've actually shown pictures of it to some people. We did a giveaway on IL Gear on the Instagram. It's, that's a tough, talk about a tough market to break into, goalie heads. I mean, STX made the Eclipse and is like still minting money with the Eclipse. Like what, 15 years later, 10 years later, 15 years? It's like 15 at this point, I think. Like that, that's like a, you know, that's a racket. It's almost a racket. You know what I mean? Like if you can make a really optimal goalie head, you're going to be able to rake it in, even though there's only two goalies on the field in every game. You know, and maybe like two or three on every team. That's like a limited market. But if you can get one head that's so much better than the other ones and dominate that, that's like a license to print money. There's a reason STX still makes it. And that's because, you know, not just because kids grew up with it, because it is legitimately awesome.
I look at it not so much from the performance of the head, since I never played goalie since Rec League when I was forced into it. I don't really have that many thoughts about it, but I think it's nice to see. To me, it sends a message that Adidas is serious about staying in lacrosse, that they're not leaving the market anytime soon. And this is it rounds out their offerings that I think you're going to be able to come close to. I guess they don't have mesh, but for like the college teams that are outfitted by Adidas, they're coming close to be able to play Adidas head to toe.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good, it's always good to have more competition.
They actually launched their Instagram this past weekend. Adidas Lacrosse has their own Instagram handle now that they didn't have before. We were just using a hashtag Adidas Lacrosse, and now there's an actual account to link with that from a photo shoot they did at a tournament, I think like 2 weeks ago, around the last time we did ILRI. And that's actually really interesting to see, because I know some people that were at that tournament and they were like, hey, what's up with Adidas? And I was like, why? And they're like, they're everywhere here at this tournament. So, you know, they're definitely putting in the work. And I think, you know, getting in kind of grassroots tournament level, you know, high school, not, you know, upper middle school level, trying to get kids to try their stuff is pretty smart.
Absolutely. And I think I also, I don't know what the status of this is, but I did hear a rumor recently that they might be signing a fairly big name.
Oh, I don't think we can talk about that.
I wasn't going to say any more than that.
Okay,
I wasn't going to say any more than that. I heard a rumor that they might be, there might be somebody on the table for them. So, which I think is another great sign. Just to have more, another big company putting money into the sport is only going to help it grow.
True.
So we are definitely reaching the point where where we have way too many manufacturers, and I think somebody is going to go out of business at some point.
Well, Gate already did, but does Gate count? I mean, they didn't count when they were out, you know? Their biggest thing was they had UVA, and then when, you know, Gate basically just ceased to exist, Brian picked up that torch and took the UVA mantle, and, you know, I think actually what you're going to see is there's going to be a lot more fights between these manufacturers over like what the kids use in the college programs. You see a lot of programs that are STX sponsored and Nike sponsored, and they make certain teams wear those STX helmets. And then there's other places where, you know, guys are wearing the Cascade helmet, but the soft goods are all Nike. And I think when I did the tournament breakdown for brands, Under Armour had like eight, almost, you know, of the field that was at least hard goods. And also, like, head to toe now, Under Armour is totally taking over that spot and flexing their muscle on their school deals. And like you made the point when we were talking about this earlier this year, that that's also a result of Under Armour upping their college sponsorship in general. And a lot of those schools also happen to have lacrosse. And the fact that they can offer lacrosse in a head to toe capacity, except for the helmet, is attractive to a lot of these universities.
Well, they're a Baltimore company, and so it makes sense that they're going to sign, you know, Baltimore, Maryland schools first when they reach into colleges. So that's why, look, like Towson, UMBC, Loyola, Navy, just because they're local, it's kind of, they're right in Under Armour's backyard.
Maryland.
And so,
yeah.
Right, right. And just so happens that that's also a hotbed of lacrosse from those schools. And that's why, like, Towson, Maryland, Navy being in the first round is a big part of why Under Armour had so many teams.
Yeah, absolutely. But we got to move on. There has been a lot of chatter this week in particular, some from even MLL players, casual lacrosse fans. Why is this World Series of Youth Lacrosse on ESPN and MLL games aren't? And I'm going to
let... And I think it's worth grouping in...
Oh. Yep, no, go ahead.
I think it's worth grouping in the Under Armour game on All-American games. We're on this past weekend as well.
Yes.
And I think it's worth... The MLL relationship isn't there, but there's certain similarities with the World Series of Youth Lacrosse right. that are worth talking about.
So I'll let you take the Under Armour All-American game and the World Series of Lacrosse, because I didn't watch either one. Not really in terms of like a silent protest, but like sort of to show solidarity for my MLL people who are not on ESPN at all anymore. But I don't know. I'll let you take that away.
I watched all of the Under Armour games and watched most of the World Series Youth Lacrosse game. And I think the biggest thing, and I was an instigator on Twitter of what you were alluding to with the MLL not being on ESPN. But I think it's the responses to that made me realize some people kind of need an explanation of the business of how these things work. I think just the basic explanation is with certain things, ESPN and likewise television networks are putting on because they draw big ratings and they're using it to, that's how they want you to subscribe to pay for the cable subscription and to sell ads. And then there are other things where the event itself is that advertising and money comes from other sources to put that on. It's a business deal between ESPN and the entities. And that is what happens with the Under Armour games and the World Series of Youth Lacrosse. That those aren't on TV because ESPN thinks they're going to draw huge ratings and bring in a bunch of viewers so they can sell ads. Those are on TV because of business deals between those entities and ESPN.
And other entities.
Yes. Right. I mean, the money coming from sponsorships, from their entry fees to tournaments and the whole thing. And not that we're bashing people for making money. You know, we get paid from the lacrosse industry. We're not opposed to people making money through the sport of lacrosse, as both of us certainly do that. But it's just it's something I think people need to be aware of, that it's not a decision. It's not a validation from ESPN that they think that the World Series of Youth Lacrosse is more important than the MLL. It's the behind the scenes, the people running the event that get it on the TV.
Yeah, and it's important to make this point that, you know, this is the first weekend that the MLL is going to have anything televised this season. The first thing they're having televised, and that is the MLL All-Star Game. And that's going to be on Saturday. They have had no other games televised on any national networks. There have been some local coverage for certain games in certain markets and certain cable, you know, offshots, like regionally. So that has happened. But this is the first kind of national thing. It's going to be on CBS Sports Network. And the reason, you know, like you said, one of the main reasons that the MLL is not on ESPN anymore, their deal with ESPN ran out. They didn't renew it. They went to CBS Sports. They had a couple more games about 3 years ago. They had, I want to say, like a third of the games were aired in addition to, you know, what they have now, which is just the semifinals, the final, and All-Star Game. And since the thing that has happened is that they haven't put up the necessary capital to get people to air their games. They can't get a big TV deal. Like, you're out there, you're like, I want to see the MLL. I want to see the MLL. Well, for every person that's shouting that from the rooftops, there's a million people that don't care. And the MLL went so far as to create their own network to air the games. And that's Lack Sports Network. Full disclosure, I have a show on Lack Sports Network, and I'm not in the, and I just got a check from them, so they do pay you if you work for them. They are a real place. I've been to the studio. It's a lot of people working hard, getting their start in the industry, people that are experienced professionals as well. And the MLL chose to build that network, which is actually a subscription network, as opposed to dealing or subsidizing any of the cost of their broadcasting their games. And that's with them already owning their own production teams before the creation of LAX Sports Network.
And I think the important thing for people to realize, especially, I saw a couple comments where people were criticizing MLO players for whining about their games not being on TV.
That was me.
And I think, you were not the only one. And I think your response was not so much that you were upset they were complaining. Your response was that they can do something about it, and they're not, through stronger steps to unionize and deal with. They have negotiating leverage in terms of what they want out of the sport. But I think it's people don't realize that it's a completely valid frustration that as a player in the league, you're upset with the people running the league that they haven't done a better job to get you on TV.
Well, yeah, if you get on TV, you're going to get more exposure for, sponsorship dollars. And more sponsorship dollars means more dollars, period, for you and everyone on your team. There are guys out there in the MLO right now sponsored by certain companies that are making like $1,500 just to wear a different piece of equipment than the guy next to them. People think these are like huge deals, and I'm going to break it to you right now. They're not. Let me ask you another thing, Patrick. What do you think the maximum salary for an MLO player is in a season?
It's somewhere in the thousands of dollars, isn't it?
It is, but give me a number that you think is reasonable.
As in single-digit thousands of dollars? I think it's less. It's I want to say maybe somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000.
That would be closer to the average. The maximum salary for an MLO player is $16,000. The maximum. I believe the maximum salary for an NLL player is at least triple that. At least, right?
I honestly have no idea about NLL salaries. I know they're other than they're higher than the MLL, which is why you see a number of guys who choose to play in the NLL. There's guys who choose to play in the NLL. That's their priority ahead of the MLL.
Right. Well, I think actually, I know we're not scheduled to talk about this next, but I think that's actually like a good place to jump forward into, the debate that was raised by, the game's most prominent outdoor game's most prominent player, Paul Rabil, getting The Rock to acquire, The Rock acquired his rights for the 29th pick in the draft from the New England Black Wolves in the indoor league. And from what I hear, like, this is a real thing. Like, this, he could play. He wants to play, from what I understand.
I was going to say, yeah, I don't have any inside info, but I think just given the 29th pick in the draft is a real asset. Like, there are some trades that happen in the MLL where guys are giving up, we'll give you a sixth-round supplemental pick for some guy, where that's not really, that's, I don't want to say a negligible asset, but that's not really that much.
Right.
But the 29th pick overall in the collegiate draft in the NLL is a pretty, that's a real asset. That's a player that you're thinking is going to have a good chance to come in and make an impact on the team.
Right. And what that brings with it, people that, players that play in the NLL as opposed to MLL, they're getting paid more based from the teams. That's just a flat fact. Like, we're going to have to, I'm sorry, guys, NLL pays better than MLL. It's not like the world's going to end, but you should probably know that. Also,
and they draw way more fans. Yeah. It's a natural.
So much more.
NLL teams are drawing on average, 9,000, 10,000. Some of the teams are drawing 13,000-14,000 people a game.
Yeah, I mean, there are teams that draw like 20. I mean, it's crazy. There are rabid fan bases for this sport that have been established over decades of success, like the Bandits, for example. But I think that what this brings up is, players do have to pick. And there are players that are never going to play box, and there are box players that are never going to play field. But the better players in each league have, by and large, have the ability to play both, but due to scheduling, cannot. And this has become more and more of a problem as the MLL has increased the date of their start time to late April to mid-April, in that range, back when it used to actually start, second week in May, first week in May. Doesn't sound like a big difference. It is. It's a huge difference. Those are at least 2 to 5 games that you could be deep into the season before you see any of your NLL guys. And what that's led to is an actual dearth of NLL guys playing on these MLL teams, because they can just go play, you know, WLA or one of the other Canadian summer box leagues and get paid probably the same amount or more to play in the, for those teams than they would in the MLL. So it's understandable that you don't see a ton of Canadians in the league unless they're younger and not established. But I think this is definitely a point that, that needs to be resolved. And I think the NLL is, you know, I've used the analogy of two towers very far away from each other with no bridge in between them. And neither guy wants to be the one that budges. I think the NLL is more apt to a compromise than the MLL, just given their leadership. And I think that that needs to change.
Oh, that was something that we saw with the NLL commissioner when he spoke at the Inside Lacrosse's industry summit and at championship weekend in Philadelphia, that he seemed, to me, my read on what he said, he was very interested in people's insight on how to expand that audience into the American field audience. And I think he was definitely open. He seemed very open to building partnerships to kind of expand that reach and grow the game of lacrosse.
And that's all it takes is an overture on someone's part. I think it's going to have to come from him, unfortunately. But it is something that needs to be addressed very soon. I've written about it, I can't even tell you, probably like half a dozen times. And nothing has changed. It actually gets worse. Hopefully opening the discussion on something in a public forum like this, like a podcast and on Twitter, will bring some more attention to it. But really, like, there are people that want to see players in both leagues. You know, Canadian people want to see Paul Rabil. I know so many, like, box people that were like, yeah, whatever, he's not going to do anything in box. Box is totally different. And then they saw him play in a combine when he was a rookie, and he destroyed people. And they were like, wait a minute, maybe he can play for us. And he, by the way, he has an NLL championship already. So he could go back and get another one. It's not like he can't play box.
And I think you see that to a certain extent, the pool of Canadian players that you're pulling from and just the nature of the box game, that you don't see as many elite athletes from Canadians. The guys who make it a lot of times are on the basis of skill more so than raw athleticism. And Paul Rabil is just, is an elite athlete by any standard. Not just a lacrosse elite athlete, but he is, you know, a guy who could compare it seems like he could be a foot, you know, he is as big, as tall, as fast, as strong as, you know, Division I wide receivers, potentially NFL type guys.
Right.
And that makes a big difference, even in any sport, in any league. And he's not just an athlete either. He's an incredible skill. I feel like it's not. It shouldn't be a surprise. It shouldn't have been a surprise to anybody that he could, if he put his mind to it, could be a fantastic box player.
Right. And, you know, it's, you could make that argument for any, you know, great athlete. I've heard it a bunch of times, like, oh, well, if I played lacrosse in high school, I'd be really good, you know, or I could be a pro lacrosse player. And it's like, there's some truth to that, but there isn't as much as you think. I think the athleticism in NCAA is much better than it was 10 years ago, for sure. I think it's not even close.
It's getting better all the time.
Yeah, it gets better. Every recruiting class is more athletic than the next in terms of size, speed, and strength. But speaking of a league that sports size, speed, and strength, and actually better rules, I believe you wanted to talk about the UWLX.
Yeah, so I don't want to pretend that I'm an expert in women's lacrosse, but I feel like I am. I think the important thing for the game is, and it applies to the men's game attracting female fans, but also the women's game attracting male fans, you're not going to succeed. And it applies to any sport, whether it's the NFL and the NBA spend a huge amount of money courting with female fans. And I think you have to look at, in order for the women's league to be successful, they need people like me who grew up playing the men's game and didn't necessarily have a lot of familiarity with the women's game to be fans. And they have made a couple of rule changes that I really liked, and in part because they both, I think, just made the game better, made it faster, made it more open, showcased the skill of the athletes far better but also made it more familiar to me as someone coming from a background in the men's game, that they took a player off the field, so it's now it's 10v10, so it's 6v6 in the half field, just like men's lacrosse, plus a goalie. They added the 90-second shot clock, which makes it more, ended the stalling and made it more up-tempo. Offsides happens at the midfield line, and they've removed some of the restrictions on requiring players to stay in place during every single play stoppage that I think both has increased the quality of the game in a vacuum, but also all those things made it more, as someone coming from the men's game as a fan, made it more familiar to me. Right. I don't know, do you have any thoughts you wanted to add, Kyle?
I mean, well, I haven't watched a lot of women's lacrosse ever. I have covered it for IL in a pinch, and I actually did coach it for about a month. I was a women's lacrosse coach, a head coach, for about a month when we were still looking for one at Tenue Webster a couple years ago. That's one of the first things that I said when I saw it and when I coached it is, why are there so many players on the field? You know, and that's such an listen, I understand how ignorant that statement is, so please don't come at me with how stupid that sounds. It's just my first thought. I maintain that thought. And I watched a couple highlights at your urging of this UWLX, and you can tell the difference. The middle of the field is so much more wide open. You were making this point too, that the next step they could do if they were going to tinker with it even more is move the goals up, but that's another discussion I'm sure you want to have.
That's something sort of talking that I think that just strikes me, and I think it's what you say talking, it's not when you see people criticizing you for that being your first thought, that I think it's a lot of people's thought coming from the men's game who aren't familiar with the women's game when you're exposed to it the first time. And I think the more that you can minimize that impact of people from the men's game looking at it and being just like, I don't understand why they don't do this, the more success you're going to have in attracting male fans to the sport who are going to grow up playing with a different set of rules. And that's one that always strikes me is you have, especially because you can see it with the creases, because almost every field that women play on has also men's lines and vice versa, that the nets are further apart, and I don't understand why they don't move them up closer so that you get the transition from end to end is faster and you get counterattacks when a fast break fails and the defense picks up the ball and is taking advantage of that unsettled situation to attack back. If there's 20 yards shorter to run, you're going to get there a couple seconds faster. And it improves the game because you just have that, you end up with fewer time running back and forth.
But it improves the pace of the game.
Scoring.
Doesn't necessarily improve the game. Improves the pace of the game, which, you know, there are purists in every sport, and I'm sure there are a ton in women's as well, even though they change the rules every year. Guess what? Men's lacrosse changes the rules every year, too. You know, there's different ways that everyone has their idea of how to make it better. I don't think any of those points are insane at all. I think they're solid points, and definitely looking at it from the lens of someone who's not super familiar with women's lacrosse and only really has experience at the lowest, you know, collegiate levels of it, where it's like one good player runs through everyone else and scores, and you're like, how does that happen? Seeing it at the higher level and seeing, you know, more of a scheme and more of a system and more pace to the game is actually pretty exciting. So give it a chance if you guys see it.
I think you're bringing up a good point. I'm not trying to argue that people who are more familiar with the game and have grew up playing it, that you're necessarily wrong for being a purist and not liking the changes. But I think that you and I represent an important audience for the growth of the game, especially at the professional and, you know, high Division I level, where you want to attract fans on TV and to show up to the games. And so I think making it easier to cross over from the men's game certainly has a number of advantages.
Absolutely. Next thing we're kind of looking at, we're doing a little close out with a little MLL discussion. Let's talk about Junior's first game with the Machine. How did you see this at all? Did you get a chance to see this game?
Yeah, no, that's watched. I'm from Ohio, and that's so the Machine are my team. To the extent, I guess I'm a Machine fan. I'll say I can say it. And so I did watch that game. I thought that, I mean, he definitely scored a couple of John Grant Jr. goals. He had that that really nice behind the back when Steele Stanway got his defender hung up. That I think actually he banked it off of the butt end of Mike Lowe's stick into the net, which was pretty awesome. But I mean, you saw to a certain extent his age. That there was a couple times whenever they were able to set up a ride, they'd sub him off and they put Brian Cole on a couple times to ride an attack.
Yeah.
That he's not the same player he was at, you know, 10 years ago. But I think he brings a lot. He's more of a bulldodger than he is going to run around you. But it was, I guess, sort of what I thought it was going to be.
All right. So
you know, based on what we talked about before.
What would you grade it? Like a B?
Yeah, I think that's about somewhere in there. Yeah, I'd say about a B, probably.
I think the one thing I noticed is that the machine offense slowed down considerably. And this is kind of the thing that happened when he was with Denver, and one of the reasons Denver traded him is that he's great going one-on-one with someone, but when he does this thing where he turns his back to his defender a lot to back them in instead of kind of keeping his head kind of turned to see where the double's coming from. And the double came a lot. And I think that Chesapeake, you know, he used to play for Chesapeake. He knows that the personnel knows him probably just as well as he knows himself, knowing everyone in that organization and how much they study film. They sent that guy, and there wasn't a release point to his wing because they wanted to give him room to maneuver. And I think that definitely worked against them in several of the 6-on-6 sets where they were like, all right, well, let's give Junior a run. And then that ends with like a turnover or, you know, a saved shot. I mean, he took over 10 shots and, you know, that's in your first game with a team, you're going to take over 10 shots and maybe not sure. I don't know if that's the best look, but you're John Grant Jr. You can do whatever you want. I think the one thing that I predicted that would be a little negative, I think came true. And that's Mark Cockerton's touches went, you know, in the toilet. And that's a guy that is a catch and shoot guy, and he finishes with like 2 assists, but he, you know, in the spots that he got the ball, if they move the ball around a little bit more instead of, you know, driving from that low wing like Junior does as lefty, you would have had a lot more catch shoots or catch move the ball than extended dodges. And I think that would have helped, you know, Ohio keep Chesapeake off balance. That's not to take anything away from Chesapeake, by the way. This is an amazing game by them. I mean, they won 2 games in this stretch and, you know, went from a team that I thought was almost dead. Just watching them play, they looked old. They looked disinterested. They made a ton of mistakes in the midfield. They relied way too much on Matt Abbott, which is what I said from the first game of the season. It's going to happen. If you rely too much on him, even Superman wears down, you know, and it definitely showed. I think in this game, they looked totally reinvigorated. Brendan Mundorf, you know, 6 goals. Obviously, Joe Walters really enjoyed shoving it in our face that we got it wrong. Within 15 minutes of the game being over, there's a chirp from Walters on Twitter that's like, message received. And it's a screenshot of all the IL staff picking, you know, Ohio to win the game. Even though Ohio won 2 in a row.
He did it twice this week.
He did it again?
He did it twice this week.
Oh, my God. I didn't even see the second time.
Because everybody from IL picked against. They played. Who did they play? They played the Machine on Thursday, and then they turned on and played. Who did they play on set? They play on Sunday, right, or Saturday?
Well, they played. They played the Lizards on Saturday,
right? And they beat the Lizards, and everybody from IL picked the Lizards to beat them.
Yes, this is the thing, and I'm going to break the wall here. I'm going to let you guys in on a little secret. Like everyone that picks those games. Not all of them watch the MLO, like Matt Kinnear, Zach Babbo, Jeff Shannon. They're not MLO guys. Like they're recruiting guys right now, and they're just doing the pick because I have to hold a gun to their head to make the picks. Like, don't get mad at them. You know, they're just looking at numbers and records to make their picks. Chris, if you want to get mad at anyone, get mad at Chris Rosenthal and I. Like, go ahead, get mad at us. That's fine. We don't care. Like, I'm not out to, like, I actually like it when players prove me wrong. Like, I'm not like Skip Bayless where, like, I have to backtrack everything. I literally don't care. I know I'm right enough that I can be wrong. It's totally fine. It's not about ego with me. Like, you can totally kick my butt in all of your Twitter or whatever, all your mentions, all of your stuff. I don't mind. You know, Will Manny did it too. You know, and we, you know, no one picked them to beat Rochester, even though Rochester won 5 games in a row. Guess what? We're not idiots for picking Rochester to beat Boston, because Rochester won 5 games in a row.
It was at home.
Like, hello? Guys, we're not that dumb. And by the way, that I watched that game this morning. That is the worst game I've seen a Rochester team play since the first quarter of last year, when the Lizards were up like 11-1 on them after one quarter. Easily the worst game I saw them play in basically 2 years. So, I mean, that's nothing to take away from. The Cannons were, by the way, really good and won the middle of the field and won the ground ball battle, all that stuff. But Rochester played poorly, beyond poorly. The worst game they've played all year. So keep yelling, keep chirping. It's fine. I don't mind. I actually like the interaction. It means you're reading our articles. So thank you. Appreciate it. And, you know, if they want to get upset or whatever, that's fine. The other thing that we wanted to go with was, you know, the announcers for that Outlaws for the 4th of July game, which shall ever be known as the attendance boosting league game, because they get over 20,000 and it boosts the overall attendance of the league. So when they make press releases later on, they can be like, oh, this many people are the average attenders of the game, when they have this like game that totally inflates the numbers artificially.
Yeah, actually, speaking of the attendance, though, I want to say the final number was like 28,000. Which, for the first time in a couple years, I believe, put it under the semifinal attendance at the NCAA tournament.
Oh, yeah.
They're at 33,000.
Yeah.
Which, it's always one of those things that people don't realize, that the most, for the last couple years, the most attended game in lacrosse in the world has been that 4th of July Denver Outlaws game.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, I make jokes about the attendance and stuff, but that's definitely like an achievement for them. They've also put on a great fireworks display, so good for them. The one thing we wanted to say about that game, the play of the game, was that the Outlaws announcers were saying that, you know, Denver looked a lot better without Junior out there. You're playing Florida, guys. Guys, they're playing
Florida.
They
only scored 14 goals.
Yeah, and they could have had a lot more.
If you just look at the it's a point I made on Twitter, people talking about it. If you look at just the goal totals per game, they scored more goals with Junior on the team than they did without him.
Yeah.
I think they only, in six of the games with him, they had 16 or more goals four of those six times. Then the first game without him, they only get to 14 against arguably the worst defense in the league.
Yeah, and they had a couple instances where they had runs of like 2, 3, 4 goals. They had 4 goals in a row to start the game, and that's when they looked at their best, and that's when they were sharing the ball. But it's not getting rid of Junior that slows you down. It's guys standing behind the net and everyone else on the field standing around that slows you down. I thought Matt Kavanaugh was like the only guy that didn't do that at times. Really awesome to watch him kind of blossom into an MLL player with this team, and you know, one of the reasons, maybe they won't say it, of trading Junior away is to give Kavanaugh more touches, even though he runs out of the midfield box sometimes. I think also no shots to the Outlaws announcers, by the way, like, but they are the most homeristic announcers in the league, and I like Ron Swearin's great. I've met him several times. He's a great dude and he's pretty astute with his observations, but they are very, very pro home team on those broadcasts, and always have been. Like, there's a market for that. I think it's strange in lacrosse you don't see more of that. I know everyone thinks that Quint hates Syracuse. I mean, definitely when Rosie gets on this podcast, make sure to ask him about Quint and hating Syracuse. He loves to talk about that because he went to Syracuse. So Rosie did. I think, you know, the aftermath of that Junior trade is going to be felt for a while, but you know, going into the All-Star game, I think the MLL is in a really great place parity-wise. You know, I think you really do have 8 teams that could make the playoffs, and I think one is out. I think Florida's out. Everyone keeps being like, well, mathematically, they have it. No, they don't. Shut up.
But I'm honestly wonder, have people gone through and figured out if they are mathematically still in it? Because in the past, with 8 teams in the league, 500 gave you a decent shot at that 4th seed. But now there's 9. So I think for 500 to get you into the playoffs, you'd almost need a 3-way tie for that 4th seed to have the middle 3 teams all end up 500. And then they have to win tiebreakers out of that which I don't know if they... it seems... Even if they are still mathematically... They might be mathematically in it. I don't know what the tie... If you go through the tiebreakers and see who those teams could be, there's a lot of... It'd take a miracle for them to get in.
I don't think they're under 500 even if they win out. Because they played 8 games. There's only 14 games. So the best...
No, they could be 7-7. They only have 7 losses.
Yeah, okay. So they have 7 losses, but they played 8 games. And they only play...
They'd be 7-7.
Yeah. So they could be 7-7, but it's not going to happen. I mean, I'm just... Sorry. Like, sorry, not sorry. Florida, you're not going to make it. I have no faith in Atlanta anymore, even though I love watching Kevin Rice play and I love that offense playing. They don't care about the ball at all. The ball has no value in Atlanta. There is no value to the ball in Atlanta. It's actually, like, kind of sad. Like, they were kicking Charlotte's butt for certain points in their game this week, and then basically just Charlotte outworked them to win the game. And, you know, even though it went to overtime and there was that horrible McCready's injury, who, by the way, he is going to be all right. He's going to miss the All-Star game. Kyle Denhoff is going to go in his place. And Mike Evans is actually not playing in the All-Star game. So I don't know if that's public yet, but that's all true. So I don't know. And some places have Charlotte in first place, but New York has a tiebreaker over them. I don't know. That's an interesting argument we had on Twitter this morning. So
it's a pretty funny, not so much argument, but I would say discussion.
Yes.
With a couple people from the New York Lizards about whether or not they were actually in first place.
Right.
But in defense of the Blaze, though, they are 3-6, but they have a positive goal differential. They've scored more goals than they've allowed. Unlike a New York Lizards team that is 3-6 or 6-3. Who has allowed more goals than they've scored.
Right.
Which, if you look at, it's one of those Moneyball things that sort of originated in baseball, is looking at, to a certain extent, the groupings of possessions that get, you know, chunked into a game are somewhat random, and to a certain extent, looking at goal differential, or, you know, in the case of baseball, run differential, is a more accurate representation of how a team has actually played.
Right. I think it's funny, like, you're a very stat-based kind of, like, analyzer of things, and I'm very much a old-school, my eyes tell me something different than your stupid numbers tell me. Not that your numbers are stupid, but my brain says, just puts that adjective in there. I think that Atlanta, eye test-wise, just doesn't pass muster on defense or transition, and New York... You know, you brought New York up as the counter example. New York's 6-on-6 defense is atrocious. Don't get me wrong, and their transition is also sloppy as well. But that offense, when it clicks, I mean, that Chesapeake game was not that close, and they still made it a 3-goal game. With a lot of, you know, there was some garbage goals in there, but not that many, and they came all the way back, and it took an illegal pocket to kind of kick it off, which I really enjoyed. One thing I am upset about in that game, they did not show the post-game handshake or any interviews after the game. And my thought on that is that they probably shouldn't have, because I think Spallina and Reese would have had some pretty choice words for anyone that talked to them. So it's probably a good idea,
they had some choice words for each other during the game, at the end of the game.
Oh, I very much enjoyed it. I love it. I love when guys get fired up. That's my favorite part of the MLL, when everyone stops, you know, hugging and kissing, gets down to it, and just gets nasty. Like,
it shows that they care. And it's hard. It's one thing I've always thought is that caring is sort of contagious, that it's hard for fans to care about the game if it doesn't appear like the players care. And the more that the players care, the more appealing it is for fans to watch.
There's a podcast name, Caring is Contagious. That's a great coaching moniker. Where'd you hear that? I want that.
I've made it up, because it's an observation. Like, it's a question when you have, like, a drill in practice. If kids, it's one of those things that if it comes down to the leaders of your team. If a drill is important to them and they care, it becomes other people start caring. That's what I mean. Like, you can try to sort of artificially make it happen by keeping score or whatever, but that's all you're doing, is trying to make some of the kids care. So they try. And then if it seems important to other people, then it seems more people who, you know, don't everybody else. It's more important to them as well.
Yeah. I think my caring just manifests in different ways of, like, cracking jokes and making fun of stuff instead of actually like showing the work, I guess. But the work is done. And, you know, the work for this podcast, I think today is also done. Second podcast in a row. No major, you know, we didn't have to hit the bleep button. No swearing yet. No one's getting fired. I think we're off to a good start here. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think your segment's done. I'm going to talk a little MLL with Rosie that we're going to tack on.
Next. Oh, that's right.
So not quite over. But your day is done at the podcast. We'll add, I don't know. Well, we need a name for the Rosie segment.
Yes. MLL with Rosie. That's terrible. Don't use that. Anyway, I'm going to jump off, guys. Make sure to stay tuned for our All-Star coverage, which will include a 3-man mock draft fantasy draft of the All-Star game. We have yet to determine stakes, but stay tuned for that. That'll be up on Inside the Cross sometime this week before the All-Star game. Make sure to watch the All-Star game on CBS Sports on Saturday. You can find me at @TheKyleDevitt on Twitter and various articles on InsideTheCross.com.
I'm now joined by Chris Rosenthal, who is an MLL writer for Inside Lacrosse. We're going to chat about a couple of the MLL topics that Kyle and I already brushed over. The big thing, what inspired me to bring you on the podcast, is I really liked your Twitter take on the commentators from the Outlaws game commenting about John Grant Jr. Do you want to give a brief summary of what your thoughts are on that?
Yeah, definitely. It's a funny situation where, one of the, they kind of had a back and forth just about the, kind of the state of the franchise now that John Grant Jr. wasn't there anymore. And it's funny to hear the exchange, because it actually started with him saying, Jr.'s a super class act, and, he wrote notes to everybody, and he thanked all the coaches, just nice things constantly. And as the conversation kind of kept going on, they revisited it several times, and, still nice things. He was always like, no disrespect to one of the greatest players ever. But then they addressed, offensive tempo. They said, the ball moves very quickly. And during that game against the Launch, it was moving very quickly. They were just saying, well, look at this, look at how this offense is running. And basically their kind of stance was that, when Junior's in the offense, he kind of dictates the flow, and, he'll get the ball and settle the situation down. And it's not so much, pass, 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 because he kind of sets up and does his thing. That kind of kept going. And, a gentleman on Twitter, brought this up to Junior's attention and was like, basically, filter out all of the nice stuff and filter out all of the, setup, and just basically say, hey, they said you're old and slow. And, he responded, I thought he kind of responded, jokingly, half jokingly, I don't know him personally. I don't know how angry he was about it, but, he just said, tell him suit up and guard me. But the kind of backlash from it was not so much people are, chiming in saying that the announcers were wrong, which is what, I would think they would do, either, weigh in right or wrong on the topic, but more of a how dare you sort of sense. How dare you disrespect someone who's a legend? How dare you say something mean to him? And that's what kind of made me start thinking that there's more of a, I feel like it's a lacrosse specific sort of trend where fans feel more of a sense of it's not about, right or wrong or accuracy in your comments. It's you just kind of have an obligation to be nice and supportive when you're speaking about the league or the players.
Oh, yeah, that's something that Kyle gets a ton of backlash about with his MLL coverage and some of his other coverages. People think he's mean because he doesn't write only positive things about people.
Right, right, and definitely get a lot of, he gets more of this than I do, but it's definitely, we hear from people or we'll hear people saying things like, bad-mouthing the league, you're dragging, lacrosse down, you're, we don't need your bad attitude, just essentially just it's a sort of a respect thing, like, if you're going to cover the league, you are expected or obligated to do so by only, you know, spewing forth positivity and, you know, very, very nice things about people, even when, you know, like a team's not doing well or something like that. You know, it's people are very upset when you mention things that aren't positive. I could understand it a little bit more if it was something like, you know, if we put out a column next week that's like, you know, these are the 10 biggest jerks in lacrosse, or, you know, these guys are super overrated, or, you know, something that seems more like an attack.
You're not talking about, like, an entirely negative column that's like, these are all of the bad things about the MLL, or these are all the things I hate. You're talking about, in the context of analysis, you say some good things and some bad things about a situation or a player.
Yeah, absolutely. I did a column last year about the All-Star game, and I mentioned I thought the game was great, and it was a lot of fun, because, you know, All-Star games are great and fun. And then I mentioned that the halftime show, which was kind of like a youth skills clinic, and I thought that was a dreadful thing to put on television, because, you know, I didn't want to watch, you know, kids learn how to play lacrosse. It was great for the kids. I was happy for them. I thought it was like a before the game kind of thing, or after the game kind of thing. And, you know,
yeah,
I saw...
Or if you're going to show it, show a 30-second montage.
That would have been perfect.
Like, before the game, like, here's what the players did, like, here's, you know, we filmed it for a half an hour, and here's the 30 seconds of, like, the funny cuts that are worth watching of players.
Absolutely. That would have been perfect. But, you know, still, I saw, you know, I got some comments from that where people were like, you know, I thought it was great that the kids were having fun. I don't know why you're hating on it. It's like, I'm not hating on children having fun. I just didn't think it was an appropriate halftime spectacle.
Yeah, or you're not hating on the fact that it happened, you're hating on the fact that it was on TV. Which, even though, yeah, and it's another thing, in the context, not like you said the MLL All-Star game was trash, and, the you know, you're never watching the MLL again. It's criticizing one aspect that people should be able to handle, that kind of targeted criticism.
Right, you would think so. And I said that I think it is a lacrosse-specific thing. You know, I'm sure other sports, you know, like the NBA has some people who feel that way, but... You know, the numbers of fans is just so much more of a larger sample that it doesn't really resonate as clearly as it does in the MLL. People are very adamant against anything that isn't positive. It's not even so much that it's mean, but there is a sense, like I said, there's a sense that people, you know, in the broadcasting or writing sort of industry, I guess, have a duty to promote Major League Lacrosse more so than cover it or discuss it.
Yeah, and I think that's a fact of the point where lacrosse is as a sport, that it's still growing, as opposed to an established sport where you're not worried necessarily about framing it as a positive, for a positive spin on this, on the league, for outsiders to attract them to it, because there's already millions of people watching.
Right. Yeah,
I don't know if it's a lacrosse-specific thing, but it's a growing sport, like a developing sport, as opposed to an established sport situation.
Right. Yeah, definitely. If there's a, you know, Major League, you know, Ultimate Frisbee or something like that, they might have a similar situation. It's definitely not something where we are on equal footing with, say, the NBA, and somebody's writing about the Philadelphia 76ers. They would, I think, probably be entitled to discuss them in ways we could not discuss the Florida launch right now.
I mean, we can, it's just people would not be happy with it.
Right, that's
probably
true.
It's probably not what we're going to talk about on the podcast. Moving on, or just kind of staying on the John Grant Jr. subject, but moving to where he is with his current team. What did you think of his debut in the Fit with the Arrested Machine, the Fabulous Five on offense, as we might call them?
Well, you know, I thought the way that he played that game was to be expected. It's kind of the way that you should assume somebody's going to play the game when they go into a situation that's already very established offense, where everyone knows their roles. You know, there were a couple kind of hiccups during the game that you expect. There was one two-man game he was running with Mark Cockerton, and, you know, he went to the inside, and I guess Mark Cockerton thought he was going to go outside, so, you know, the pass kind of skipped through You know, it was just a turnover. And, you know, I mean, that sort of thing's going to happen. But it's John Grant Jr. still capable of producing, you know, a solid offensive game. And I think he's going to be able to do that. The players he's surrounded with are, you know, they're intelligent guys, and they're going to be able to figure out how to get the most of everyone's abilities. So, you know, I have faith in the squad.
Yeah, that's Kyle was a little bit more negative. I tend to agree with you more that there were some issues, but it's a guy playing with a new team. You kind of have to, your expectation level has to be that it's not going to be running on all cylinders right away.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, after one game, I'm not going to be inclined to say, you know, oh, well, this definitely isn't going to work, or, you know, this is definitely going to be a championship squad. You know, I mean, we'll see what happens next week or, you know, next game or the game after. But I feel like it might actually be a good sort of situation for John Grant Jr. to get into, as opposed to his Denver situation where you have a lot of not only new players, but they had a lot of rookies coming into the league. And, you know, maybe Ohio might be a little bit better off, may not be as inclined to kind of stare in awe in that sort of situation. Not to say the Outlaws did, but, you know, if there is a little bit of that, it's certainly understandable.
No, that's true. That's true. Moving on to did you publish today, yesterday, your MLL ranks column?
This morning, yeah.
This morning, okay. You do weekly power rankings of the MLL teams, and the one that really stood out to me was you have the Blaze. You drop them below the Outlaws and move them into eighth, and I feel like the Blaze, their record's only 3-6, but they've scored more goals than they've given up. And I feel like that is a solid indicator of where their performance actually is. What's your defense of ranking them eighth?
Well, I think I think there's a couple different ways to kind of dig into deciding how to rank these guys. And the Outlaws winning in their most recent game, you know, granted it was against the last place team, so you know, it's not as huge a deal as some of the other wins, but you know, defeating the Lizards before then. So they seem to be in a pretty solid situation. Whereas the Blaze, it was more so just an inability to win these games. They just keep, you know, the most recent game against Charlotte was essentially one that, you know, they had that game and they gave it away. It is the best way, you know, I want to, without saying anything bad about.
You're allowed on this podcast. You're allowed to say bad things about people, especially pros. I feel like if we're talking about junior high kids or high school kids, I'm more kid gloves. But in college players, you start to get to where they can handle some criticism. But MLL players are adults; they can handle it.
Okay, thank goodness. Yeah, so they gave it away. They, I mean, it's a game they should have won. And honestly, I don't think anyone in that locker room would disagree with that sentiment. And the problem with the Blaze is, you know, I really enjoy their style and watching them play, and their attack line is phenomenal. But these games that they're losing them, and they're giving them away late in the games. You know, these are leads that they fail to hold. It's not like teams are jumping out on them and then they're, you know, coming back just barely. These are things that they should ideally, if they're going to be, you know, a legitimate playoff threat, these are things they should be able to take care of. And they're not doing it. Whereas, you know, a team like the Outlaws, what I can go on as far as their recent performance, you know, it's two solid wins, you know, defeating New York and defeating, you know, Florida. Granted, we already spoke
both
on them.
Both in Denver, though.
Yeah. What that means, you know, they do have a tremendous home record. But, you know, I mean, they still have to win the games. And, you know, those are the games provided in front of them. You know, so, I mean, if they win those games, then that's good. They should win them. But, you know, if New York can't beat them in Denver, I'm not inherently inclined to attribute that much of that to the game taking place in Colorado. There certainly is, you know, people may have a, more of a biological approach to it. Maybe there's an altitude issue or something like that. But I don't know how many outlaws reside in Colorado anyway. So I don't know how much to weigh in on that sort of thing when it comes to home wins.
The explanation and I actually had an MLL player I was texting with somebody about this during that game is the refs. Is that they have, not to say that they're bad, but they have it's the same four refs every game. And a player was asking me what it would take to do an analysis of what's their like their face-off record and how many penalties do they get home versus away.
So it's not so much a classic home field advantage situation with like your fans and sleeping in your own bed. It's more of a home cooking sort of situation.
That player was asking me was more so not that they were accusing, but they're saying that's what's talked about around the league and asking sort of, are we just overreacting to it or is it actually going on?
Oh, I gotcha. Well, you know, ultimately you're going to win your games or you're going to lose your games. And, you know, if Denver wins every game they play at home and, you know, can maybe steal one or two more, they're going to the playoffs. So, you know, I don't think I can discount, you know, where they play too much as far as comparing them to a team that's losing, you know?
That's fair. Wrapping this up, do you want to plug where we foot? What's your Twitter handle, Rosie?
Twitter handle is ChrisRosie22. And, just keep reading stuff on Inside Lacrosse. We have a bunch of dumb ideas that we're going to be rolling out over the next couple weeks towards the end of the season. I'm looking forward to writing.
Yeah, check out his column Wednesday morning. It was published the MLL ranks and every week. You can follow me on Twitter at Lax Film Room and on Snapchat at Lax Film Room as well. Follow me on Instagram at Lacrosse Film Room. And we will, I think this is going to be a weekly podcast, at least. So tune in next week to listen to Kyle and I rant and discuss all things in the lacrosse world.